From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a crazy story about a gigantic pearl. We're talking a 14-pound pearl discovered in the 1930s. At one point, this pearl was valued at tens of millions of dollars. And that's part of the story told by the writer Michael LaPointe in The Atlantic magazine. Would you be surprised if I told you at least one con man is involved in the story? After this.
KUER's community of sustainers do so much for the station. Because of their ongoing contributions, we're able to bring you award-winning local news, NPR coverage, Radio West, and our own podcasts. Starting at $5 a month, you can be a sustainer too. Then, next time you hear a story you love, you'll know you made it happen. Become a sustainer at KUER.org.
This is Radio West and Beck Fabrizio. This may be one of the craziest stories you've heard in a while. A massive and ancient and incredibly valuable pearl is discovered inside a giant clam off the coast of the Philippines in 1934. And the legend that takes hold of the pearl is mysterious and it's gripping. And it goes like this. The ancient Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu carved an amulet depicting himself and Confucius and the Buddha. And he had this amulet planted into a clam so a pearl would grow around it. And as the story goes, it grows and it grows and it gets transferred to larger shells and then larger shells. And when it's discovered more than 2,500 years later, it's 14 pounds. 14 pounds, 1 ounce. That's the story. And as the writer Michael LaPointe tells it in an article for The Atlantic magazine, that story is everything for the pearl of Lao Tzu. Today in the program, LaPointe is joining us to tell the story, not the legend, though that's pretty interesting, but the real story, as far as he can tell it, of this giant pearl. And it includes a couple of murders, an Elvis impersonator, Al Capone's illegitimate son. Michael LaPointe has written for the Paris Review, for the New Yorker. His article, Chasing the Pearl of Lao Tzu, appeared in the June issue of The Atlantic. He joined us yesterday from the studios of the CBC in Toronto. That's where he's based. Before we say too much about the backstory, I actually did want to kind of just jump in, as you do in the article. It's this legend, of course, of how a diver drowns retrieving the pearl. This is the story from 1934, because I think this is an intriguing way to start.
The original discovery of the pearl took place on the island of Palawan, which is in the Philippines, in May 1934. And the legend has it that the diver who originally retrieved the pearl was actually trapped by the giant Tridacna clam and drowned. And it was only when the clam and the body were dredged from the ocean and the clam was pried open that the indigenous people beheld this wondrous, marvelous pearl, the world's largest pearl. And in the sort of convolutions of the surface of the pearl, the local chieftain beheld the face of Muhammad, and he named the pearl of Allah, in sort of tribute to that face that he beheld. It looks like a sort of turbaned man. This was the story put out by the Filipino-American Wilburn Cobb when he eventually acquired the pearl from that same chieftain.
Yeah. We'll come back to this too, but describe the pearl, if you would. First of all, it's huge, as you said.
It's huge. It's 14 pounds, 1 ounce. It's about the size of a football, American football. A lot of people have a very visceral reaction of disgust with the pearl, to be honest. You know, if I tell you that I have a 14-pound pearl, your mind probably thinks of like a perfect orb, a white sphere.
Shimmery.
Shimmering with that sort of luminescence. In reality, it looks like a kind of brain. It's got multiple sort of bizarre warps and folds. it's far from a polished object. People who have beheld the pearl say that it is beautiful, that it has a kind of porcelainous quality to it. But most people who see pictures of it think to themselves, well, it doesn't even look like a pearl. You know, what could you possibly do with this thing? One lawyer joked that, you know, you'd never wear it around your neck unless you're the Incredible Hulk.
Right. You've never held it, of course.
No, it's locked in a safe deposit box in Colorado Springs.
And in Colorado Springs, of all places. I have to say, that's another such a strange twist. Anyway, keep going.
It's divided between three kind of ownership parties. And in order to remove the pearl from its safe deposit box, at least two of those parties need to be present. And getting them to agree to absolutely anything, even the basic facts about the pearl, is impossible. So getting them to allow me to see it was not possible.
Let's get back to Wilburn Cobb, because he's kind of the first great character of the story. There's this story that was in the Natural History magazine from 1939 that you relate in the article, how it is that Cobb comes to be the owner, or at least sort of the pearl. Tell that part of the story.
He was visiting Palawan around the time that the pearl was discovered, and he immediately wanted to own it, to buy it from the chieftain. And the chieftain refused, saying, you know, anything with the visage of Muhammad in it cannot be purchased. It can only be earned by devotion and sacrifice. And lo and behold, not long after, that same chieftain's son fell ill with malaria. Wilburn Cobb was an affluent Filipino-American, and he had access to Adabrin, a modern medicine that was able to save the chieftain's son's life. It's actually a rather sweet aspect of Cobb's personality that he stayed apparently with this child for a long period of time, nursing him back to health. But at the end of that experience, his reward was that the chieftain gave him the pearl and said, "This is yours now. You've earned it by sacrificing your time and attention to my son."
How do you describe Cobb's relationship with that pearl? It seemed like a little bit like, you know, the ring in Lord of the Rings. It takes on this kind of weird obsession for the people who get a hold of it.
That's true. Everyone whose life has been touched by the pearl has a sense that they've been part of something historic. In Cobb's case, he was a natural storyteller, a natural embellisher. He wanted to be a writer. He loved telling adventure stories in the kind of vein of H. Rider Haggard or these sort of old-timey adventure writers. And the pearl became his muse in a way. In his relationship with the pearl, he elaborated these profusions of stories all about its grand historical status. You know, Cobb was already rich, which is an important aspect of him, in a way that distinguishes him from other people who came into contact with the pearl. He was already rich, so it was never for him a money-making scheme or anything like that. For him, it was really a status symbol and a way to be connected to the kind of fantastical world historical realm that entranced him.
Yeah,
and that's how he eventually comes up with the story of Lao Tzu and the pearls having been created by the ancient Chinese philosopher.
It gets us to the idea of what is true and what isn't true. And in some ways, it's kind of the underlying theme of the article itself, the story of what we can say for sure, how much is fantasy, how much is fiction. I'm imagining that was part of the appeal to you, this part of the story.
Absolutely. I write fiction mainly as my main writing practice. And, you know, I think everyone who writes fiction admires any story where fiction and fact intersect and they become indistinguishable from each other. That was definitely the appeal. It was definitely also the challenge of writing the piece, that everything that you can say about the pearl exists on this sort of shifting ground of fact and fiction, and that it's almost impossible to distinguish the two, partly because in the case of Wilburn Cobb, who really lay down the foundational myths of the Pearl,
yeah.
he never seemed to have a very good compass about what was true and not true.
Yeah.
He told lies in the way that a child tells lies,
yeah.
which is to say, not maliciously,
yeah.
but with a sort of indifference to the distinction between fact and fiction. And so it's rather like going back and trying to test the earliest grounds of any kind of religious, you know, story.
Yeah.
The fable-like quality of it makes it impossible to ever definitively say what was true and not true about it.
Well, the idea of faith seems to come into play too, because mm-hmm. as much of the story is also about this kind of faith that there is something special about it. That's the other part of it that is kind of extraordinary, because in some ways it's not beautiful.
No.
But it's magical because of the story.
That's right. Cobb managed to sort of imbue it with this aura. It's rather like a sort of, if there's an ugly painting in someone's house that you visit, but they tell you that Rembrandt painted it,
yeah.
it suddenly has this quality to it that you think to yourself, well, maybe it is beautiful. Maybe my reaction to it is invalid in a way. The stories that Cobb elaborated out of the Pearl set it on this course where even people who found it ugly still wanted to possess it, still wanted to be a part of it. And that was because they had really, yeah, put their faith in the story, put their faith in the idea that this thing was an ancient object created by Lao Tzu, and that it was a symbol of world peace and religious harmony, as opposed to being a kind of lump of clamshell from the bottom of the ocean off the coast of the Philippines.
Yeah. Not to be a buzzkill about any of that, but what can you say or do you want to say about what was actually true about the story? I mean, he did actually get it from a chieftain in the Philippines. A diver actually did drown. I mean, there's that part's true.
That I am at least comfortable saying is true. I mean, nothing could be said for sure.
Sure.
I managed to have a remarkable conversation with the daughter of Wilburn Cobb, who retained his papers. And she is a retired psychotherapist and in good psychotherapeutic fashion has a sort of detached view of her family life and is able to speak dispassionately about her father and his many embellishments. And she was instrumental in clarifying some of those early things, you know, things that definitely you could say were true. One is that, the diver drowned. Maybe retrieving the pearl, maybe unlucky, and then the pearl happened to be in the clam that he was trapped by. And it's true that Cobb did nurse the chieftain's son back to health. That is something that definitely happened. The whole idea that the chieftain would name it the Pearl of Allah because there's the face of Muhammad in it is fairly heretical idea in Islam. So that strikes me as an obvious fabrication done later. And of course, the whole Lao Tzu story is absolutely impossible.
ludicrous.
Super ludicrous. Yeah. I mean, if only because the place it was discovered is about 3,000 miles away from
exactly.
where it would have been made by Lao Tzu. Yeah.
Well, someone comes up with a story, and we'll get to that to explain that here in a bit. But Cobb is an interesting figure to me because, on one hand, as you say, his motives weren't about money. But he also kind of ditches his family for a time. They come under the occupation of the Japanese during World War II, and while he's off having this adventure in America, which is not to say he was a bad guy necessarily, but he's having this jolly good time, and they're back going through all kinds of hardships. I thought that was kind of interesting.
That's definitely an abiding source of resentment for his daughter and for, I'm sure, his entire family. He goes to America with the ambition to eventually bring the Pearl to Hollywood and write adventure stories for the movies. And by virtue of leaving his family in the Philippines, they undergo tremendous hardship under the Japanese occupation, things that, children should never have to see or live through. I take a sympathetic view of Cobb, well, mainly because I do continually see him as this kind of everlasting child, that to the extent that he was a narcissist, he had a sort of child's narcissism, and to the extent that he was incapable of being a kind of stalwart presence as a father, it was just also because he was so ill-suited to that role. This is a view that his daughter also shares somewhat. She ended up being kind of his parent in a way as their lives progressed. He was just never suited to live a life of any responsibility. And so the fact that he spent most of his life in a kind of dreamland alone with this pearl, that's a fate that seems fitting for him.
Yeah. Let's talk about what it's worth, because that's a big part of the story. Cobb comes to the United States, comes to America in 1939, and it makes its way into this Ripley's Museum. And I know he's hoping for, as you say, he's got big plans for it, but the novelty starts to wear off, and it seems like that's part of this story, is at first that's pretty cool, and then it kind of starts to fade a bit, and everyone who's connected to it tries to recreate the story or get this excitement going again. Tell the story about how we do get an appraisal. And you have to tell the story about this mysterious Chinese man, Mr. Lee, because
sure.
This is where it really kind of starts to get exciting in some ways.
The first price tag that's ever put on the pearl, allegedly, is done by a man named Mr. Lee, who Cobb claimed visited him at Ripley's in 1939. And upon seeing the pearl, Mr. Lee burst into a hysteria of weeping, and claimed that this was not any pearl of Allah with the face of Muhammad. Instead, this was the long-lost pearl of Lao Tzu. This is a apocryphal story about the founder of Taoism that claimed that Lao Tzu carved an amulet and placed it into a clam to grow a pearl around it. And as the pearl grew and grew and grew over time, it needed to be transferred into ever larger shells until it grew into this 14-pound object. Mr. Lee at Ripley's relates this mythological story to Cobb and says, you know, you found it. You found this pearl, and says that it's worth $3.5 million to him personally, Mr. Lee. And this is, of course, 1939, so you can imagine how much that is.
Big money.
This is the first time that any talk of money has really floated about the pearl. But Cobb gives Mr. Lee the same answer that the chieftain once gave to him, which is that, you know, I can't sell this thing. It's not meant to be sold. So while I'm very flattered, the answer is no. In good, you know, storytelling fashion, Mr. Lee disappears back to China, never to be heard from again, sort of like being visited by a Mr. Smith from America on the other side of the world or something. And so, you know, nothing can ever be verified about him. But that $3.5 million spontaneous appraisal first sets this benchmark that this isn't just a novelty. This is actually a gem worth a colossal amount of money. And that appraisal, so-called, has grown over time until it's kind of maxed out now, with an owner telling me that he believes it's worth $100 million. U.S.
Yeah. So interesting about the sense of how much it actually might be worth. But the only time it's actually sold is in 1979. This is after Wilburn dies. Never does sell it himself. His daughter Ruth sells the pearl. But for somewhat less than $100 million, $200,000, that was the only actual price this thing ever got, at least at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ruth never really liked the pearl.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, as a child, she saw it, rightfully so, as a rival for her father's affections. when he died, his estate was in a total shambles, and it fell to her to clean it all up. And the question was what to do with this pearl. It was now a tax liability. You know, at that time when he died, I think the most recent appraisal put the price at $42 million.
Wow.
So, you know, that's a – it would be an absurdity to have to try to pay the estate tax on that. So she got it kind of quietly appraised for $200,000, which to her seemed like a fair price. She never put much stock in the enthusiasm of other people who claimed it was worth so much more. So, you know, it depends on how you see it. If you believe that it's worth $100 million, she got ripped off very, very badly. She got fleeced. If you believe, as she does, that it was a fair price, then, you know, she still stands 40 years later as the only person ever to actually sell the pearl.
Yeah.
And she did so for $200,000.
Which brings us to another great character in the story, Victor Barbish. Let's talk about who he is. You see in the article, Cobb, I like how you put it, Cobb wrote the original gospel for the pearl, but Barbish was its fundamentalist. Tell us a little bit about Victor Barbish. I have to say there's this photo of him. It's so great in the magazine. And you get a sense immediately of what kind of guy he was. He's got this high-collared dress shirt on, unbuttoned to his belly, basically. He's got this gold chain and this gold watch and this kind of, I think this was taken in 1984, so he's got that kind of strange 80s fro that a lot of white guys had in the day. Tell us a little bit about Victor, because he's great.
Yeah, Victor Barbish is ultimately probably the most important character in the story of the Pearl of Lao Tzu. There is no such thing as a biography of Victor Barbish. I often say there's only sort of patterns in fabric. He was a self-inventor on an epic scale in the grandest American tradition of the con artist. In truth, he was born in Pennsylvania to a butcher.
Wait, before you get to that, just say some of that stuff, because he may have been a monk, he said. He was a prize fighter. Oh. He was a partner to Sammy Davis Jr. He said his father was Al Capone. I mean, this guy was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, he his origins are modest, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
But his origin story is a grand epic tale. He claimed that he was the illegitimate son of Al Capone. And that's where he gets that kind of gangster aesthetic that he played to the hilt for the rest of his life. I mean, you name it, he claimed to have done it. He claimed to have been a prize fighter, an opera singer. He claimed to have been a CIA agent, a prisoner of war. He claimed that he had been possessed by demons, abducted by aliens. Whatever you needed him to say, he would say it. Whatever image he needed to project, he was able to project it. And he was an incredibly successful fabricator.
Yeah.
You know, he died in 2009. Never having been really called out on his fabrications, he was an incredibly successful con artist. And I should say, too, his family obviously doesn't see him that way. They see him as a visionary. They see him as an American hero, a patriot. But every other person you speak to calls him a con artist.
Yeah. And Barbish takes Cobb's story that he has for the pearl, and he makes it grow. He makes it even better. What's the spin that he puts on it? Because then he starts to, he says he actually gets a check, or almost gets a check for this thing.
Many times he claimed to have been close to a sale of the pearl after he himself purchased it from Cobb's estate. You know, Cobb only ever floated the idea that this was the Pearl of Lao Tzu. A crucial distinction between the men is that Cobb said that this man named Mr. Lee told him this story. And so whether or not you believe Mr. Li, you know, the degree to which you believe in the story of Lao Tzu's pearl. Victor Barbish, there was never any nuance there. This was always Lao Tzu's pearl to him. And when he set about resolving all of these contradictions in the story, so for instance, we just joked a few minutes ago about the idea that this thing could end up off the coast of the Philippines when it was thousands of miles away from the seat of the Chinese Empire. But Barbish masterfully elaborates this tale of how the pearl was put onto a trading ship and was lost in a storm and was swept overboard, and that's how it ended up at the bottom of the sea until the diver accidentally discovered it. There's a way in which, as I call him a fundamentalist, but he has a kind of theologian's diligence about resolving all of these tiny little contradictions in the myth. And he managed to pass them off. He claimed to have met a member of Mr. Li's family. He resuscitates that aspect of the story,
right. And
says he's going to get paid like $60 million or something like that for the pearl at this time, 40 or 60. But every time that he was about to make a sale, some kind of spectacular accident would occur. In the case of trying to sell it to Mr. Li's family, partner in that enterprise, you know, bled to death during a botched bypass surgery, and the check was lost. And, you know, again, the Mr. Li's family just disappeared and was never heard from again. There was always something like that.
Yeah.
He was the master of the sort of dog ate my homework excuse.
Yeah.
Calamity.
But the thing that's interesting about the story and the way you write about it is, like we were saying, I mean, on their face, these stories are ludicrous, and of course, Barbish looks like kind of the stereotype of a con man, but you say in the article that he managed to pull this stuff off because his targets had this fatal thread of greed, and Barbish managed to manipulate it. Like, he knew that the value of it was in the story, and he saw that greed, I guess.
That was his special talent. He was the sort of person who, if you presented him with a room of like 100 people, almost on sight, he would be able to tell you which one he could manipulate. And he always chose people who had a few qualities in common. One, they were very rich. They had been successful one way or the other, often through some criminal practice, had lots of money. And secondly, they were greedy. And greedy in a way that caused them to suspend their skepticism in a kind of full tilt effort to get that big payday. So he always managed to put one over on them because he was speaking their language. He was speaking the language of greed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the reasons why the story was so, you know, difficult to report is because after Barbish dies and is sort of removed from the stage, everyone that he leaves behind is one of these greedy people.
Yeah.
It's a world that he created populated entirely by people motivated by money. And that was his great success. That was his great talent. That and whatever charisma he exuded, which is sort of an ineffable thing, and now that he's gone, we can never really know it firsthand. Some combination of this intelligence and charisma, he was able to get away with this for so long.
That's Michael LaPointe. His article for The Atlantic magazine is called Chasing the Pearl of Lao Tzu. It appeared in the June issue of the magazine. We have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
You hear stories on KUER. They make you think and laugh. Sometimes they frustrate you, and sometimes they even make you cry. When that happens, what's the first thing you want to do? Share the story, of course. And thankfully, local stories you hear on the air wind up at KUER.org. You'll find news, podcasts, and all the Radio West you want, plus community events. When you hear a story you love, spread the love at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the damnedest story you've heard in a while. It's about a gigantic pearl, a 14-pound pearl discovered in the 1930s. The writer and critic Michael Lapointe has written an article for The Atlantic magazine called Chasing the Pearl of Lao Tzu. We're talking about it with him. We have a link to that article, by the way, on our website, radiowest.org. I wanted to ask you about Laura Lintner Horn, because she puts another twist in this story. She thought for a time that Victor Barbish was her father. You find her in Florida. She's writing a book about him. Explain the connection between Victor and Laura, because she lives in his home, and there are some insights here that I thought were strange and interesting.
She didn't just think he was her father for a time. It was 50 yeah. years, over 50 years, she believed that Victor Barbish was her father. And this is a lie that sort of has a crucial foundation for Laura, which is that she never really had a stable home life in her very earliest youth. As soon as she was born, she was thrust into a kind of lie about her parentage. She was given up, not for adoption, but given up by her mother to be raised by her grandparents. Mm-hmm. And rather than being candid about this arrangement, her grandparents said that they were her biological parents and that her actual biological mother was her sister. So there was always a lie being visited on Laura about her parentage. And when Victor Barbish married Laura's aunt, whom she believed to be her sister, he started putting it out there that, in fact, Laura was his daughter.
Yeah.
She's, I think, 7 when Victor Barbish marries her aunt. Her life up to that point had been very bleak. It was a very depressed household living with her grandparents. And so this came not just as a surprise to Laura that Barbish was her father, but it was a welcome surprise. She was overjoyed to learn that this man was her father. She absolutely worshipped him. He was an icon to her. She was a child. She believed everything that he said. And so
he said a lot of crap. You just need to mention a little bit of this. He had mentioned later in her life, of course, that he had had her ex-husband who was abusive to her. He had had her killed. Yeah. And tell the alien story, because this is particularly strange.
Every time he was driving down State Road 70 in Florida, not every time, only when there were just women in the car, his head would suddenly wrench back and his eyes would start to roll around. And this would be his enactment of alien possession. And I mean, it speaks to how tight his hold on Laura was, that she had absolutely no skepticism about this. She would, try to wake him up, Victor, wake up, shaking him. And then, as he, wrenched the car from side to side and extremely dangerous, terrifying, traumatic experiences. And then he would suddenly, snap back and would be driving calmly. And he would have no memory of this close encounter with aliens. He always had something like this, kind of almost like a ejector seat of the mind, something that he could use to totally disrupt a situation. Earlier in his life, he would claim to be undergoing post-traumatic flashbacks to his time as a POW. In reality, he never was a POW, but he would have these kind of fits of traumatic flashback. Later on, he would claim that he was being possessed by demons. And so that would be another way of kind of throwing a fit. And at the end of his life, it was aliens. And interestingly, this sort of maps onto like what was very popular in movies and film at the time that they were being done. But he always had something like that up his sleeve. And so Laura, she lived through all of that, and she believed all of that for over 50 years. She never doubted him or his story, and she never doubted the reality of the pearl.
Yeah.
what it was worth, what its destiny was historically to bring peace and unity to all the religions of the world. She was a perfect mark for him.
How does the pearl end up in Colorado Springs, of all places?
Victor Barbish moves there from California, where he acquires the pearl, and he moves to Colorado Springs. There's some controversy over why he leaves California. I've been told different stories about that, you know, his need to get across state lines, as it were. But he arrives in Colorado Springs in the 1980s. By this time, his name is in the Guinness World Records as owner of the world's largest pearl.
Yep.
And he spends about 20 years in Colorado Springs, and he visits a great amount of havoc upon the people there, acquires millions and millions of dollars of investments into the pearl, always claiming that a sale is just around the corner, and people would, you know, provide him either an investment with kind of shares in his company called the World's Largest Pearl Co. Incorporated, yeah, or they would, you know, provide him a short-term personal loan just to kind of finesse the final touches on a deal. And that's how he got his money out of them. And then, of course, there would be some kind of last-minute calamity that would cause the deal to fall through.
Textbook con man behavior in some ways. And then one of the things that mm-hmm. he does is he makes up a foundation. This is kind of his last scam. In 2005, yeah. Moves to Florida, sets up a foundation called Pearl for Peace. And I think yeah. he makes millions on this con.
It's been said that he made about $5.5 million in his last 2 years or so on the Gulf Coast. He lived in Sarasota. Part of that was through the Pearl for Peace Foundation. Another part of that was through his jewelry cons, which are sort of convoluted. But yeah, his nonprofit organization. I mean, this was always part of his veneer. He would always make friends with the police wherever he went. He was an avowed Republican patriot who was on the side of law enforcement. His son, Mario Barbish, told me that the Pearl for Peace Foundation was a sort of precursor to the so-called Blue Lives Matter yeah. counter movement. And that was this sort of good patriot image that Barbish projected. The Pearl for Peace Foundation was pledged to help law enforcement by buying them new equipment, bulletproof vests, and helping out disabled police officers and things like that. And if you signed up for this foundation, you would receive a membership badge, looked like a kind of sheriff's badge with the Pearl for Peace logo in the middle of it, which is a dove soaring with the pearl in its talons. But of course, not a single penny of this ever went to anyone in law enforcement. Yeah. It all went directly into Barbish's pocket.
It's interesting how no journalists really came out and just debunked this story. In fact, you say in the piece that I think you say time after time, journalists failed to apply any pressure to this story.
Yeah, they really took it at face value. I mean, to be fair to them, it's not as if this was, Watergate or something like that and they got it wrong.
Yeah.
The pearl always pops up in the news as a kind of novelty item, a sort of, you know, the last 30 seconds of the newscast telling you, you know, the world's largest pearl is on display today in Studio City in Los Angeles or something like that. Yeah. They clearly didn't do much due diligence in the story. They really helped import the fiction into reality by putting it in the public record that it was 6,000 years old, that it was, worth $40 to $60 million. And of course, you know, people like Victor Barbish use that public record to reinforce the veracity of the myth so that it became this kind of feedback loop of him putting out spurious stories. And then once they invaded the public record, he would use those records to undergird his claims. So yeah, no one ever really applied any pressure to the story. The only place that ever really did was a blog run by a woman named Caitlin Williams, who subsequently passed away. during the course of my reporting. And she wrote these long blog posts in which she attacked the myth from all different angles. And she would wage war in the Wikipedia page trying to fight Barbish and his acolytes in the Wikipedia page. But she told me that her research was also at the same time very sloppy. And she told me, she said, I'm too passionate on this subject to be entirely credible. So that was part of my cue to try to tell this story in a way that was fact-checked and solid.
What was it like for the fact-checkers at The Atlantic? I mean, this is a story that's hard to pin down.
I think it was a bit of a nightmare for them, an enjoyable experience, but also part of the pleasure of writing the piece is to kind of float the fiction for a little bit in the story before deconstructing it. And that's not something that a fact-checker would ever really approve or condone, you know, that you're because, you know, if someone stopped reading the piece after the first like 2000 words or whatever, they would have a very different perspective on the Pearl than someone who follows it through to the very end. So this kind of tension between fact and fiction always had to be modulated throughout the course of the piece. And that was definitely the challenge for the fact checkers. That and just dealing with some of the characters in the piece who would write long, semi-coherent emails objecting to this or that thing that we were going to be running. That was also the other challenge for them.
There are so many twists to the story, and we can't get to all of them. I'll just mention that there happens to be a couple of murders that play into this kind of final twist for this story. And it brings up the idea that there are a lot of people, a number of different people who want to see that pearl sold. You know, they're hoping for a cut. But you have to put pearl in scare quotes in some ways, because beyond all the other questions around it, like, you know, where it came from and how much it might be worth and all the people connected to it, I mean, is it an actual pearl?
Well, that's a very good question. That's the question that no one asked for a long time. There are two sorts of pearls. There's the pearl that we all colloquially seem to, you know as a pearl, which is a tiny round little gem from an oyster with a mother of pearl that gives it that signature luminescent sheen. And then there's pearl as a technical term, which can signify anything that a shelled mollusk creates to repair its mantle. So even a snail can make something that can technically be called a pearl. But of course, a gemologist has no interest in selling snail pearls. And likewise, a gemologist has no interest in selling clam pearls.
Yeah.
And that's what the Pearl of Lao Tzu actually is. It's a pearl from a giant Tridacna clam, and those types of pearls lack mother of pearl or nacre, which gives them their status as gems. Instead, this looks more like a work of porcelain at best. And so no right-minded gemologist would ever go around trying to sell these as pearls. You would never, you know, smaller versions of the same kind of pearl you would never put on a necklace and charge a lot of money for. They just simply aren't gems. But part of the con of the pearl has always been to operate within that gap between what the common person thinks of as a pearl and then what is technically a pearl. Because if I tell you, you know, I've got a 14-pound pearl, you probably imagine one of those little pearls that you know is very precious and worth a lot of money, and then you just multiply the value out of all proportion, right? That is exactly the sort of cognitive trick that was being perpetrated on the people who would invest in the pearl finally. They would believe that they were getting involved in something that naturally was very precious, that had innate value in the way that we think of, you know, gold or a pearl as having innate value. The joke was ultimately on them that this was actually perhaps not entirely worthless, but close to worthless as an actual jewel.
Yeah. I have to say that's the saddest part of the story, I think, in some ways for me, because you early on, you get this affection for the pearl, or at least the way Cobb tells the story, Wilburn Cobb. He creates this mm-hmm. kind of beautiful fantasy. And then as it moves on and as you get people like Victor Barbish and then now his son, Mario, Mario, for example, writes this pamphlet. He's carrying on his father's legacy in some ways. And you say in the article this, you say it's this pamphlet that he wrote about this story of the pearl. You say it was almost sad to see Wilburn Cobb's fantasy ground up. And it did. It starts to lose its magic the more you manipulate it. I mean, Cobb's fantasy was not true, but it was harmless. And I don't know. It seems like that's the sad part of this story, that it took the kind of nice mystery out of it.
Yeah, I mean, to me, if there is value in the pearl, it's in the story of the pearl.
Yeah.
I often think that all the characters in the story can be divided up between people who actually want to possess the pearl itself and then people who want to possess the story of the pearl in some way. And I myself am obviously of the second category. The people who want to actually possess the pearl itself are the ones who have fallen for this idea of its great value. And they're sort of the tragic characters in the story, with the exception of Victor Barbish, who manages to pass away before he's held to account. The people who want to possess it as a story, they seem to find some redemption ultimately in their experience, despite having lost a lot. I mean, you could argue that Laura, in a way, lost the first 50-something years of her life to this story. But because she breaks away from her actual connection to the physical thing and establishes a connection to the storytelling quality of it, that is where she finds her hope and her future, away from this calamity that's been at the center of her life. And so any time that the story of the pearl, as in the case of that brochure you mentioned, is sort of degraded, there is a bit of sadness to it, because ultimately that's the only value that it has, is in its myth. My role as the journalist reporting the story was that I had to kind of bring that myth down a notch.
Yeah.
But I'd like to think that I gave the story its kind of proper hearing and give it its proper proportion, neither too exaggerated nor totally besmirched. And any time that the story is being used, as in Mario's case, to try to make a buck, that's also, you know, when you really do feel, yeah, something sad about it went astray somehow along the way. It could have been much different.
What's going to happen to the pearl, do you figure?
Oh, you know, that's a good question. I think it's going to remain in that safe deposit box for a while. There's a man in Beverly Hills named Peter Hoffman who is one of the three owners. He was one of Barbish's earliest partners in the Pearl scheme. And he is extremely elderly now and rather obstinate in his insistence that the Pearl is worth, you know, he lists it on his website as being worth $75 million. And so I'm not sure, as long as he is owner, that anything meaningful will happen to it. But I don't know what you do. I don't know what you do with it. If you sell it to someone, then buyer beware.
Yep.
And if you put it, say, in a museum, what is the story that you tell about it? Is it the story that Wilburn Cobb put forward, which was, from its very beginning, part fiction, if not mostly fiction? Is it the story that I've written, which is ultimately its true legacy? And then if that's the case, you know, why would anyone want to put it on display? It now represents more misery than it does beauty, frankly. So I'm not sure. My hope is that the people who are still connected to it can find a way to cut loose somehow and just take the loss and move on, because the way in which it's just being it's been passed down the line, and whoever is left kind of holding the bag is the sucker in the story, I hope that they can just find a way to cut their losses and move on.
Laura said to you that everybody ends up defending the pearl until they lose, and then they lose big.
Yeah, very big for some people. I mean, these investments that Barbish would acquire from people were not $100 here and there. They were kind of a minimum bid of like $100,000. It's like the smallest that I ever heard him collecting from someone. So these are people's hopes and dreams, people's entire livelihoods were sunk into this object.
Michael LaPointe, his article Chasing the Pearl of Lao Tzu appeared in the June issue of The Atlantic Magazine. We have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. He joined us from the studios of the CBC in Toronto. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. Our thanks to Tess Goodwin. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.